Hello, I'm Phil Lowe, and this is Somerset Lost and Found, in which we dig into the history and folklore of the county. In today's episode, ever thought about your nearest village church and how its impact on the village may have changed over the years? It's not something, I confess, I'd thought a lot about until the church in my village, that's Kingston St Mary, just north of Taunton, celebrated its 800th birthday this year. So I went in search of some facts about its distant past, and I found today's guest. Ray Stokes has made an extensive study of the history of St Mary's Church, and I'm delighted to welcome him today. Ray, thank you for coming. Welcome to the podcast. Ray, I was planning to introduce you as a folk historian, but when we first met, I tried that term on you, and I'm not sure it quite landed. So if you'd like to enjoy a moment of self-publicity, you can tell the listeners a bit about how you describe yourself and your research.
Well, I'm just an amateur historian. I've always been interested in history, and I heard a talk some years ago about the history of this church and this village in particular, and became involved with the local history society, and so hence my interest in this church in particular.
Okay, well, there's a lot I know that we've got to get through, and it might be that we actually take a second episode to tell the whole story, but because actually I want to start by going back a bit. I mean, 1225 is pretty long time ago when this church was founded. Presumably there was a church here before that on the site.
We believe there was some sort of rudimentary church here. It would have been a fairly simple building, probably made of wood with a thatched roof and a small chancel. As you probably know, Christianity came to this country in the 6th century. And so, although some believe it came earlier with the Roman legions, but certainly by the time of the later Saxon kings, Alfred the Great being the most famous, they were Christian.
Right.
And so Kingston, which is an abbreviation of Kingstown, reflecting the fact that land around here was owned by the king, almost certainly would have had that sort of Christian background by then.
Right, yes. And would they have sent out, I mean, we often think of missionaries being sent into heathen places. Is that something that the kings like Alfred the Great would have done?
Yes, indeed. Well, we're wives anyway, because the wife of his predecessor, Ethelred, founded a Minster church in Taunton with a chapter of priests with the task of going out to convert the heathen. Whether they got as far as Kingston, we don't know, but it's quite possible. That Minster church was later upgraded to a priory, priory of St Peter and St Paul in Taunton, and they certainly then took an interest in the church here.
So would the priory have been instrumental in building a proper church? I'm sure the church that came before was equally proper in its way, but would it have been the priory that would have established the church as we know it now?
Almost certainly, yes, and they would have been influential in the building of this church. The priory took responsibility for the chancel of the church and for its upkeep and its repair and refurbishment. We know because the Bishop of Winchester's accounts talk of a chaplain of Kingston 20 years before this church was built. But we know nothing else about the church that was here on this site because, of course, when they built this this stone church, they obliterated all traces of the earlier building.
Yes, and I want to ask you about the Bishop of Winchester in a second, but you said that the prior was responsible for the chancel. Now, for the kind of uninitiated, there are kind of two, if I do it in layman's terms, there are two main areas of the church. There's the nave, where the congregation go, and the chancel, which is the kind of home of the priests. Is
correct.
That right? Yes.
Correct.
And so the upkeep of the chancel was very much a matter for the church establishment.
Indeed.
Yes.
Okay. And the priory also appointed the priests here.
Right.
Which is why Kingston is a vicarage, not a rectory. The vicar was acting vicariously.
Right. So had it been a rectory, what would that mean?
But the rector would have more power then over right. the glebe lands and the incomes coming into the church. Right. Whereas a priest was appointed and was acting on behalf of the priory. So the vicar was acting on behalf of the priory.
Right. Okay, got it. And you mentioned the Bishop of Winchester. That's, I mean, at first glance, that seems quite a long way away, Winchester, to have a bishop taking an interest in our proceedings. But I suppose it's all part of Wessex, is it?
It was part of Wessex, and he was the successor to the Bishop of Wessex. Don't forget, this was Roman Catholic church. This was hundreds of years before the Reformation and the Church of England was even formed. The priory was, as I say, set up in Taunton. And, they more or less guided what happened here.
And the Bishop of Winchester was appointed or was under the command of the king?
Yes, but the Bishop of Winchester was given the ancient prior, the ancient manor of Taunton Deane.
Ah, okay.
And had a lot of land in this area. In fact, the rights, the most deeds of most properties around here, still he still has the mineral rights to those properties. Certainly in the deeds of my house.
Right. Okay.
The Bishop of Winchester, his predecessors built Taunton Castle, as you probably know. He set up a deer park north of Taunton, a vivarium, the fish park in what is now Vivary Park, and he had a game park at Nailsbourne, just on the outskirts of Kingston St Mary, where they bred swans, cranes, all sorts of delicacies for the table at the Taunton Castle. So given this level of royal and ecclesiastical interest, it would be very surprising if there wasn't a church here, right, you know, for a long time before this church was built.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me when you're talking about the Bishop of Winchester and all his kind of possessions and so on, you seem to get this in sort of every period of church history, this idea of a lot of largesse at the top and a lot of materialism at the top and then a kind of much more Spartan kind of life at the bottom. I mean, I don't know how much evidence we have that was a kind of ongoing thing in those days.
Well, I think the lifestyles between the bishops and the and the higher clergy and the people that would have attended this church in 1225 couldn't have been farther apart.
Right. Well, let's talk about the congregation then. So, from 1225, we're coming into sort of medieval period. Who would have been here? I'm guessing that a lot of local people would have worked on the land in an area like this. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. Huge. Yes, right. Huge proportion of the people here would have owned living on the land.
Yes,
sheep, of course, were big. Fruit was grown here. There were mills down through the valley. Fed by the streams running off the Quantocks, and they process wool for
it. Yes, we'll come back to wool, of course, because the wool trade had a bit of a part to play.
It did.
In
very
this
big
church.
Part. Very big
so
part.
We'll come back to that. Now, you mentioned that, of course, this is before Henry VIII and the Reformation, so you basically, to all intents and purposes, it's Catholic Church. Does that mean services were conducted in Latin?
It does, yes. Right. And almost certainly most of the service went above the heads of the local congregation, who, of course, were illiterate peasant folk, in other words. And what they saw in the church set them apart. There was a screen, a wooden screen, right the way across the church at the entrance to the chancel. There were two side altars, of which there are still signs. And they stood on bare earth because the church would have had a bare earth floor. It would have been a very damp, drafty place, very cold. Yet the other side of the screen, which almost certainly had a tiled floor, would have been priests in their richly embroidered gowns, well lit with candles. The altar would have gleamed with gold and silver, all glinting in the candlelight. So they might have been... suspect they were seeing a glimpse of heaven on the other side of this screen.
Yes, so something aspirational. And I suppose there's, a lot of content in the Bible about how difficult it is for rich people to get into heaven and so on. So they're speaking directly to these people and saying, if you play your cards right, you can have some of this. And did they, I mean, when you visit Catholic churches in, you know, in Italy or France, you often will see frescoes and so on painted on the walls, which is not something you tend to see in Anglican churches. Was that part of the communication with the congregation?
Indeed, it was. Bible stories were illustrated on the walls in the nave quite often. There were wall paintings which told the story. Many churches, and possibly this was one of them, had what was called a doom arch, where on one side of the arch, going up, were the righteous going up to be judged, and coming down the other side were the sinners being cast down into a fiery hell. They got the message through without being able to read or write. The clergy got this message through to the people there.
Yes. And I am just to pause for a moment. I'll just explain to the listeners. I didn't mention we're actually talking in the church itself today, and it sounds like somebody is, I don't know what they're trying to do, force entry or something, but we'll carry on. One of the joys of this podcast is we just like to have an informal chat rather than sounding too professional. So we'll see what happens with our visitor, and we may stop if necessary. So is it kind of, I mean, so it's almost like a kind of social media of its day, really, these kind of illustrated sort of pronouncements about, you know, do this, or here's a story about something that should influence you to kind of change your life. The kind of YouTube of the medieval world.
Long way of looking at it.
I have to say, I'm a big fan of frescoes. I love frescoes, and I think a shame. It's actually through talking to you that I realise that the reason we don't have them in this country is because we don't have so much of a Catholic church anymore. But we'll come back to that. You have a service conducted in Latin. You've got a kind of aspirational kind of content. And in the congregation, was there any kind of social element? Because I'm guessing, you know, you work on the land all week. On a Sunday, you come to church, see lots of other people who do your kind of work that you might not have seen during the week. Do we know, were people particularly kind of social in the church? You know, the whole coffee and biscuits after the service business. Do we have any of that?
I imagine for a lot of that. Probably very glad to get out. The congregation were, of course, as you said, services were conducted in Latin. Mm. They may have known certain bits of it, which they'd learnt by rote, but they wouldn't have had a great deeper understanding of it. They were spectators rather than participants, as a congregation is today. And so I suspect they were very pleased to get out at the end.
Yes, and probably quite silent when they were in here, by the sound of it, yes.
Yes, and of course there was no seating.
Yes.
So they had to stand in this cold, drafty church.
Ah, okay, because the pews that we're looking at now came in... actually, they're quite old, the pews in here, I think.
1522.
Okay, so standing before that. The one story, it's always good to meet someone who's done research, because sometimes you can debunk a story, but there may not be any evidence in this particular church. I remember reading years ago that the reason incense was used in church was to cover the smell of the congregation.
I've not heard
that
one before.
No, you haven't, okay. That's my school for you.
That is the reason. I mean, high court judges used to carry nosegays because of the smell in the courtroom. So it could well be.
Right, yes, okay. Well, we'll leave that one. So we said that we'd talk about the wool trade, which you'd mentioned, because that was pretty significant round here, wasn't it? I mean, a lot of money came into the village.
Indeed. Yes. There was a lot of weaving went on in homes. As I say, there were mills down through the Buncombe Valley there, which were processing fulling mills, processing wool, either for the weavers in their own homes or later on to the bigger establishments in Taunton, the town itself.
And That paid, money from the wool industry, I believe, paid for certainly the tower here, which wasn't here before. What date would that have been at?
1490, roughly.
Okay. And so that was built on the proceeds of the wool trade. And,
yeah.
Anything else?
The wool trade, well, when the economy boomed, as it did in the late 15th century, around 1480, 1490, those that benefited from it, I think, felt they needed to give something back. Mm. And they did it. They showed their gratitude by investing in their local church. And in Kingston Church, particularly, around 1480, 1490, a huge amount of money was spent on this church, remodelling it in many ways. The tower, as you say, was built, nearly 90 feet high, built in three stages, would have taken some years by a group of masons that moved around, probably, that were itinerant crews, that worked probably not in the dark winter months, because it would have been too cold, too wet, and very difficult. It would have been the equivalent today, I suppose, of our Hinkley Point project, in that you would have had a large workforce coming into the village, which probably only numbered 400 inhabitants in the larger parish. But you'd have this crew of maybe up to 100 masons and associated workmen coming in, living probably on site. Some of them may have been even sleeping in the church, maybe on rough nights, building not only the tower, but also the south porch to the church, which is around 1520. All of this went on at that time. Windows were changed into perpendicular windows. Previously, windows in this church were narrow slits, only one of which remains, one window frame remains at the back corner of the church there. They weren't glazed, of course. They had wooden shutters, hence it would have been very drafty in the church at that time. But probably around the beginning of the 1500s, they've started putting glass into windows, perpendicular windows rather than the narrow slit. So it would have let a lot of welcome light into the church. But the crowning glory was the tower. It was known, and still is known, as the Pride of Kingston. Beautifully built from local stone, with hamstone used for all the tracery and the parapets at the top. All that stone would have been brought onto this site. Don't forget, no roads as such.
Yes.
Rutted tracks drawn by oxen. It would have taken hundreds of tons of stone to build that tower.
Yes.
You can imagine what that would have done to this village. I say, the modern equivalent probably is Hinkley.
Yes, or any local residents listening to this will also know that just at the time of our recording, we've got massive gas main replacement going on all the way up and down the Kingston Road. And I imagine the kind of, yes, if you imagine the fury that a lot of people have about that, and then have that for 3 or 4 years. But I suppose, I mean, as it's the church, I mean, people were pretty obedient, weren't they, to the church? They must have just thought, well, if it's the church, we mustn't complain. It's, you know, God's will.
Yes, it's difficult at this time to tell what their reaction was. But I think they were immensely proud, certainly, of the outcome. This is one of three towers built, we believe, by the same architect, for want of a better word, but under the same gang who probably moved from one to the other. The other is Isle Abbots and Staple Fitzpaine, both south of Taunton. A.K. Wickham, the church historian, said in a book on church histories that he thought this was the best of the three. The perfected model, he called it, which rather leads us to believe they learnt from their mistakes on previous ones.
Yes.
Whether that was mistakes of architecture or timing or weather, I don't know.
Yes.
But this was the perfected model. It became known as the Pride of Kingston, and is still used on note heads and things as an iconic symbol, readily recognisable.
And it also has a kind of stonemason's feature, or a few stonemason's features, that these things called hunky punks, I believe they
Indeed.
Are, little kind of characters.
Yes, at the corner, at the four corners of the tower, are gargoyles, which are designed to take the water off the roof. But on each face between the gargoyles is this funny little character. They're called hunky punks because they're hunkering down, and punch was the old-fashioned word for short and stout, as in Suffolk Punch Horse, of course. And these, to me, I think, show that the Masons had a sense of humour. It could well be that these experienced Masons had worked on maybe even cathedrals inside, when it was the practice to put a caricature, usually of the master mason, and put it somewhere in the stonework of the church high up. And these, I think, are probably an attempt to do that. They're in jokes which are lost on us today. One of them is reckoned to be a very stout woman giving birth to a very fat baby. It's difficult to see because of the weathering these days, but that was obviously a new joke of some sort.
Yes, and those are obviously still there for anybody who wants to come and look at them. And I think they've kind of lasted rather well, I have to say, for such a long time. Okay, so we're really getting towards the Reformation, I think, as the next kind of dramatic thing that happened. So I think most people obviously aware Henry VIII, for various reasons of his own, wanted to reduce the influence of the Catholic Church and start a new church with different rules. Now, what would be the first that the village would know about this? Because it's actually quite a big change, isn't it, if you're just somebody who's used to the same thing every Sunday?
Well, of course, one of the first things he did was dissolve the priories.
Oh, okay.
The monasteries. So
right.
The Priory
by Bishop of Winchester, yes,
was dissolved, and responsibility for the church passed from the Bishop of Winchester to the Dean and Chapter of Bristol.
Right, okay.
So that was the first thing, and that sparked off a chain of events here and in all churches for which they took responsibility. They would have seen that through. And, of course, the reformists removed any emblems that they thought were papist.
Right.
One of the first things they did was whitewash over any images on walls.
Okay, so no more frescoes.
Doom arches, things like that. They also took out side chapels, and we had two, one north and one south. The vestiges of those chapels are still there, Pacino, washing bowl in the wall, the other side. And so they also removed, sadly, a lot of the figures that were in the niches around the church.
Yes, and the niches are still there, of course, so you can see.
Are.
And in fact, I mean, it just shows how unobservant I am most of the time, but I came here with showing a friend around here, and we walked past the outside wall of the church, and he said, "Oh, Henry VIII," and pointed to an empty
Correct.
Recess.
Yeah.
And I just hadn't occurred to me that that's what it was about. Yes,
but they went to strange lengths on the back pew. We're very proud of our carved pews here. One of them has a motif you often see in a Catholic church of a shield with the five wounds of Christ on it.
Right,
and somebody's had an attempt to chisel off the features on the thing. Yet the font, which is only 2 feet away, has the same emblem in stone, and that's been left.
Oh, so was that just carelessness?
I have no way of knowing that, but it just shows that it was pretty random.
Yes.
It wasn't done in any sort of systematic way.
Well, they had a lot of churches to come and organise, didn't they, I suppose? I don't know how many people were available to come and chip away at pews and so on, but they probably just did their best as quickly as they could. But now, this would mean, of course, that services were now no longer in Latin, is that right?
Indeed, that was the upside of it, was services were now in English, and the congregation could at least follow the service in English and the readings from the Bible. But yes. Of course, it had other ramifications. Once you make big changes like that, out went the screen right the way across the chancel.
Right.
That disappeared. That went. But you were left with a chancel which had blank walls because you've got rid of the side chapels.
Right.
So you've got two dead ends in effect, one north, one south. So they had to cut large arches through the chancel walls so that the chancel was incorporated into the church.
Right. And could they still do those sort of adverts for heaven that they used to do in the chancel, or were they frowned upon in the Protestant?
I think
movement?
Anything which depicted figures, holy figures, was frowned upon.
Right, yes. The other thing, I'm just sorry, coming back to the congregation now, one thing that we haven't talked about, we've touched on, is, I mean, obviously you had things like that, you know, money from the wool trade. You must have had wealthy families around as well. I just wondered how involved they would be in the life of the church, because you've got a rump of the congregation that are very poor labourers, and then you'll have they might be their employers, I suppose, the landowners and so on.
Well, the biggest one were the De Waals of Hestercombe Estate.
Oh, OK, so now Hestercombe Gardens.
Yes, indeed, best known for its gardens. Well, this Hestercombe came within this parish.
Mm.
And in 1356, after the Battle of Poitiers, where the French king surrendered, and his sword allegedly rested on one of the shelves here.
Oh, right.
But the De Waals married into the Hestercombe. John De Waal married the daughter of the Meriots, who owned Hestercombe, so he then became the Lord of Hestercombe in around 1370. And he is buried in the tomb there.
Right.
This large tomb in the south aisle. So that required that the south aisle was enlarged, widened. So the family would have paid for the widening of that aisle, a window at the end, an altar, all the rest of it. That was, and still is referred to, as the Hestercombe Chapel.
Okay, right.
So a large amount of money came in. The far end of that same aisle is known as the Tetton pews, because the families from Tetton House, the Herberts, the Dykes, the Acklands, latterly the Herberts, paid for the maintenance of that part of the aisle,
right.
The roofing, anything else that needed done there.
Because I suppose as the chancel was the responsibility of the originally the priesthood and now the priesthood.
Dean and chapter of Bristol.
Thank you very much. Yes. So the nave where the congregation were, I mean, that was that the responsibility of the congregation?
Yes, indeed.
Keep it up.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So if the wealthy families hadn't done their bit, it would have been pretty grim, I suppose. It would have
well, you had wealthy merchants here.
Right.
People earning a living. And, you know, the names of the church wardens are people who owned land around here, farmed. Mm-hmm. Owned mills, owned various other businesses, because this was a self-contained community, as
yes.
were all rural communities in those days, you know, with the blacksmith and all the rest of it. And so you had those wealthy businessmen who were be putting money into the church as well as those families.
Mm. But you know, I want to go leaping ahead now, but I see that we're kind of running out of time. So, Ray, you know, I think we might have to ask you back to talk about what happened after the Reformation, bring us up to date. I'm assuming there's a few dramatic... But, oh, you're nodding, yes, OK.
Some very dramatic.
Oh, fine, OK, brilliant. Well, we will. We'll arrange that and have another podcast on the more recent history. And I think I may be able to find somebody to talk about right back at the other end about the kind of missionary work of the Dark Ages, and we may do a podcast on that as well. But Ray, thank you so much. It's been really interesting hearing about all of this and actually sitting in the church while we talk about it. There's been a real treat. And I shall now go and hunting around for all these features. So thank you, Ray. Enjoy the rest of your day. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time.